Welcome to Plain Talk. Plain Talk has a new podcast every 2 weeks with up-to-date information about aviation technologies for general and business aviation. From home to cockpit to boardroom to personal tech, Plain Talk provides informative information for pilots, industry insiders, and aviation enthusiasts alike. My name is Phil Lightstone. I'm a general aviation pilot with over 1,900 hours in my logbook, flying almost every week with over 30 years' experience in the technology and aviation industries. Okay, we're here at Insight Industries, also known as Insight Avionics, with John Youngquist, their founder and CEO. John, welcome to Plain Talk.
Well, thanks for having me.
Oh, our pleasure. So I seem to recall that Insight was founded in the 1970s. What got you into the aerospace aviation industry?
Well, I was an airplane owner, and I was a pilot at age 16, and I bought a Bonanza airplane when I was about 24, I guess, and I discovered there were a number of things that I thought should have been available for airplanes of that type, and they just weren't available. Now, at the time, I'd been working as a design for hire guy doing processor-based development projects for people. So I had done countless projects involving microprocessor chips and had a background in programming and instrumentation. And I eventually figured out that we needed better engine monitoring. And based on that, I began to explore that as an opportunity.
Yeah, and I really appreciate you bringing in design version one of what is now arguably one of the most cool technologies in an airplane.
Yeah, that's the first prototype that I showed you a moment ago, and it was just to prove the concept as to whether or not it was a worthy idea to present all the cylinders at once. And how this really evolved was I bought what was the leading technology at the time, which was an Alcor EGT meter and a switch. And this switch would allow you to look at one cylinder at a time, and it was EGT only. And I tried to learn things from that, and I found it fairly difficult to do. And I found eventually that I would record data from it, and I would go home and plot it in a graphic mode. And that led me to the thought, well, what I really need is a continuous graphic display in the airplane, and that's really what started the graphic engine monitor. So the device that I showed you there is the first prototype that was put together to just try out the graphic principle in the airplane, see if it had merit. And turns out it did.
Well, no doubt, being able to see all your EGTs and CHTs all at once, you know, delivers so much more information to the pilot on how to operate their engine, lean the engine, etc.
Yeah, what seems obvious today was by no means obvious then. In fact, as soon as I had a competitor, they began to spread the idea that this was too much information. No one could understand it. You didn't need all that in the first place. Of course, that was a competitive move. It wasn't a technological move. And the way this actually evolved was I was out flying this instrument around, and I was showing it to a few friends to see if they would grasp it. And I wondered whether people would be technically skilled enough to learn to use this thing. And I was concerned that, you know, not everybody was a flying engineer, and that a lot of people wouldn't really have much interest in this, and it may not be a very successful idea when you look at the broad picture and the broad spectrum of the airplane owners. So I flew this thing around, and I liked it, and I showed it to some friends, and they liked it. But an event happened one night that really convinced me it was worthwhile. And I was coming back in my Beechcraft Bonanza at night in the wintertime between layers from far western Kansas. And it was a very odd night, and I don't think I've seen one like it since, where I had no visual stimulation below me or above me. The layer above was so thick it couldn't see any stars or anything else, and the layer below was so thick I couldn't see any city lights. So I was just stuck there in kind of a black hole, I guess. And everything was running smoothly, and the air was flawlessly smooth, and the engine was purring away. And all of a sudden it got rough. And I wondered if it was an imaginary rough because I was in this odd state or whether it was real. And I looked at what would become the graphic engine monitor, and I saw one of the columns was several bars above normal. And I thought, look at that, the engine's rough and the instrument is actually telling me what cylinder is the issue. So I pondered whether it was a bad plug, so I switched mags, and when I did, the cylinder that was too high immediately plummeted to zero. The engine, of course, got very rough for a second or so, and then that bar came back. And what had happened was I had a shorted spark plug, and turning off the mag that was driving the non-shorted spark plug, of course, caused combustion to cease in that cylinder, which makes things very rough. But that abrupt temperature change popped the short out of the other plug, and the problem went away.
Wow, amazing. So, absolutely amazing.
So this event proved that not only would this identify that I had a problem, that I knew what cylinder the problem was in, but I could see the problem remedy itself, and I could see the effect of the repair, and I could see everything return back to normal. And that was a series of events that was hard to do with any other instrument. And that was really the pivotal moment that convinced me this thing was worthwhile.
Well, no doubt, John. It's really become almost a standard in aircraft cockpits these days.
Yeah, it's funny how it was slow to be accepted, as these things often are, but it seems like you see them in most of the airplanes these days.
Yeah. So, you know, proudly built in Canada, here in Fort Erie, Ontario, why not reduce costs and manufacture overseas?
Well, it's not clear you really reduce total costs, because there are other challenges and other troubles you encounter by doing that. And the in a lot of cases, on products that have a huge manual labor content, by going to some place where the manual labor is very inexpensive, you get a big savings. But because our instruments are built predominantly by machine, and there's not too much manual labor in it, even if my labor were free, it wouldn't affect the manufacturing cost much. So it doesn't make a lot of sense, and we're not in a market where we have competitors biting at our heels for 2 cents of price difference. So it doesn't make a lot of sense. And then, of course, you have total control of what's happening. You have total control of inventory and other things. And when you get things done outside, what you end up doing is try and minimize the price by maximizing the volume of stuff that you get built. So what you save in manufacturing cost, you accumulate in inventory holding cost, because you keep more stuff in stock all the time. And it's pretty easy to make a defensible case that it costs more to save money than what you save.
Of course.
And you know, if this were a consumer product that was being made in the millions and being sold through TV ads, why, the argument might be different, but of course it's not. And so we end up with an issue where hard to justify there would be any savings, and there could be instead lots of troubles.
Certainly 100% quality control, you know, through keeping everything in-house.
Yeah, it makes a difference in the we have immediate capability to react if something isn't being performing right or needs to be changed. And you know, over the years, we've had various bits and pieces done by subcontractors, but over the years, we brought all of those pieces in-house, even to the point of doing our own injection molding and things like that.
Well, I have to, you know, look back at the GEM 610 and 1200 and think about, very proudly, as a Canadian, the innovation that Insights created, adding a
infrared or IR port to move data to an HP 200LX palm top. And FYI, I still have mine. And then using a spreadsheet to view the data. I think looking at the 90s, that was exceptionally innovative at that time.
Well, that was driven for some interesting reasons. The data is useful in the instrument. It becomes more useful when you store it and can look at it later. And it becomes even more useful when you have a clear and flexible way of analyzing it. And obviously, at this point in time, I mean, when the first GEM was introduced, nobody had a personal computer. But now, when the second generation comes up, personal computers and laptops were more widespread. Now, the problem is that how do we get data into anybody's laptop? And how do we talk to people over the phone and say, push this button, click on this icon, or do whatever it is you're going to do when we've never seen their laptop? We don't know what version operating system they've got. We don't know what applications they're running. We don't know anything. So for us to have a staff that would be somehow clairvoyant on all modes of computer operation and all brands would just be impossible. So in order to make the problem uniform, we decided we had to deliver a package which included the computer and included all of the components that had to be dealt with so we could sit down on the phone with somebody and walk them through step by step with exactly the same hardware that they had in front of them. And that's really what drove the HP 95-200 path. And of course, it was a quality device built by a quality company, and it was not terribly inexpensive, but it wasn't overly priced. And it had this unique feature of the infrared interface. Now, making the infrared interface in the instrument was a unique challenge because we had an interfering light source in the form of a plasma display. And we also had, of course, the issue of how does this infrared interface work in bright sunlight? And of course, there's plenty of bright sunlight in an airplane cockpit. So we managed to develop solutions for all those problems such that you could point this thing at an instrument in the cockpit and gather useful data in a few moments. And, you know, it was very flexible and capable. And at the time, we were limited on how much data we could practically store in the instrument. So you had 30 hours maybe of flight time, depends on the airplane type and the configuration. But you had numerous flights that you could save. And you could elect to not transfer flights that you didn't perceive to be very interesting, and you'd still have storage for the other ones. And so that was what moved that product in that direction, was to get a uniform platform for data handling. And of course, once it was on the HP computer, you could even spreadsheet it there, or you could transfer it to a bigger platform to use that for your spreadsheet application.
You really planted the seeds for what is now ubiquitous data access off the current G line, easily pull data off a secure digital card into your laptop, up to the cloud, or onto a spreadsheet. You look at how companies like Savvy created a business around helping mechanics and pilots execute better, faster maintenance decisions through having access to the data. I think it's just innovation that you created was really ahead of its time.
Well, it was quite a project to get all that implemented, and among the challenges, of course, are to create files that anybody can read in anybody's operating system, and that was useful. And then, of course, the ability to interpret all that data easily in a spreadsheet, and to manage the file system and everything in the instrument was a lot of work, more work than one would imagine. But we also have made in the new G series instrumentation, we've made a number of significant changes concerning troubleshooting. One of them is the probe diagnostic page. And we used to spend a fair amount of time on the phone talking with people to try and get them to diagnose their engine or their instrument. And sometimes you didn't know whether it was an engine problem or a probe problem. And so we've always had this issue of an instrument with lots of sensors and lots of wires. And as a result, there's always a potential for something to be wrong. So in the G-Series, we create a new way to diagnose all the probes. And the interesting thing is that when we applied for a patent on this new instrument, the patent attorney, who's very very knowledgeable, looked at this, and I had a claim on how to measure resistance. And of course, the resistance we're measuring is the probe resistance, and we're measuring this while the probe is generating voltage. And we're doing it without disrupting the measurements. And he said, you know, if we can get a patent on measuring resistance, it'll be the first patent on measuring resistance in 200 years.
Wow. Amazing.
And whether that's precisely true or not, I don't know. But he was trying to say that nobody has ever attempted to patent measuring resistance in recent decades. So surprisingly enough, we did get patent coverage on our resistance measurement technique because nobody had ever done it before. And if I thought in the in this decade or the previous one that we would reinvent measuring resistance, I would think, how would you ever do that? But anyway, we managed to do that. So the new instrument reduces profoundly the amount of effort that people are putting into diagnosing their engine and their installation. Now, if you have a problem, you have a bar that is doing strange stuff on takeoff, well, did the probe fail or did the engine fail? Well, now in a matter of a second, you can look at the diagnostic page and determine if it's a probe or an engine problem. We've never had that before. And you cannot underestimate how important that is because it affects the confidence that people have in the instrument. And in a lot of cases, they would not equate the readings they're getting to a bad probe. And but then sometimes it's a bad engine. And I mean, decades ago, I had a fellow come up here with his mechanic because his engine instrument supposedly didn't work. And it happened to be a very elaborately decked out Blanca Super Viking. And I asked if I could fly his airplane, and we did the mag test as you always do and determined nothing. And I switched mags in the air, and I found 3 bad spark plugs on one mag and 2 bad spark plugs on the other.
Wow.
And this taught me a very interesting lesson that this mag check that we all do as a religious event every time we fly really doesn't solve the problem we're trying to solve. It really doesn't find the issues. And the issues are that if the spark plug has a crack in it, it won't necessarily fail until the combustion pressure is up at cruise power configuration. So anyway, we landed, and I suggested these guys to change these plugs before they go, but they didn't. They flew home with 5 bad spark plugs in the airplane, and that was with his mechanic.
Not cool.
Not even a reasonable thing to do. So in any case, the new instrument does a number of things. And I mean, the goal of the new instrument, realize that the first generation instrument was limited by a processor chip that was very limited in capability and very limited in memory. In fact, it only had a single kbyte of program space. And the subsequent instruments that had, like the 610 series, they had 4K of program space. And it's a lot more, but it's not a huge amount. It's enough for an icon storage, and that's about it. And then the newest ones have 128K and have an enormous amounts of program in them. And so when we opened up the instrument to this new capability of having huge programs, we could do all sorts of sophisticated things, stuff that wasn't even imaginable in the early days. And that makes a big difference.
So, you know, we've seen a number of manufacturers build graphic engine monitors and lightning detectors and such. imitation must be the highest form of flattery for you, John.
Well, the danger of imitating stuff is if you didn't develop it, you probably don't understand it. You usually don't get it right. And there's a lot of stuff out there which may have some of the look or feel, but it really isn't the same thing. And they always have a lot of things missing because we have extensive patent protection on the new series of instruments. And the all the good stuff that people really benefit from is all patented, so you won't see that in a competing instrument for many years to come. And the diagnostic page, for example, is one you don't see. Vibration analysis is one you don't see. The split fuel is another one. The fuel stability measurement is another one that you won't see. And there's just dozens of things that we have put in there as patented innovations. It won't be copied. So even though they may from a distance look similar, when you dig in deeply, why, there's an awful lot missing.
Well, and speaking of your innovation, you created some nifty technology called the Strike Finder, and it's really become a de facto name for a lightning detector, which I think is also very flattering. With ADS-B weather and XM weather being aged, are pilots still relying on your Strike Finder?
Well, the terrain-based weather systems have some severe limitations. One is that all the information that they're using is intended to be weather information for TV stations. It's not intended to be aviation weather. What this means is that the radars that are built to serve certain communities for domestic weather information. The radars don't necessarily have coverage between cities. There is nothing that I'm aware of that you can depend on to get an indication of where the coverage is and where it isn't. And I learned this at a meteorological seminar that I went to many years ago. And a professional meteorologist was up giving a talk, and he was showing radar images on the talk. And he said, well, you see this area over here on the left? It looks like there's nothing there, but don't take that for granted because there's a hill there, and I don't get any coverage past this point. And he spent a fair amount of his time interpreting the idiosyncrasies of his installation and where he got good coverage and where he didn't. Now, as pilots, we have no information on where the coverage is good or not good. We do have information like there's no coverage over water because the radars aren't built in the water because they would sink. And we don't have any coverage in the mountains because the radar doesn't go through the mountains. So when you look at a lot of the western states, there's plenty of terrain there which is not conducive to getting good weather information from radar. And that is true, by the way, of weather radar on board the airplane. I mean, I have extensive experience in flying radar-equipped airplanes and in using airborne weather radar here in this building. For many years, I had an airborne weather radar on the roof that I could turn around and watch weather. So I have many hours of storm watching in the comfort of an armchair. Whereas your average pilot encounters a storm for 10 minutes or so and has flown around it or by it or somewhere. But I've been able to look at these things to a very more detailed extent because I've used it as a ground-based radar. So the radar information that we get is limited in many ways. And my concern is the pilot doesn't understand what its limitations are. It's limited by where there is coverage. It's limited by what the quality of the coverage is. And it's limited by the fact that there's no weather information if you're going to the islands. There's no weather information going to Mexico. There's plenty of places where there's no weather information in Canada. And yet the screen always looks the same. There's nothing that says there's nothing here. Now, when you have a lightning detection system on board the airplane, you've always got it with you. It doesn't matter whether you're going to the Bahamas or Bermuda or the Cayman Islands, it's always there. And that makes it a vastly different capability than depending on them transmitting stuff to you. And then, of course, your ability to receive the transmitted stuff varies in quality and capability as you fly around. So you never really know what you've got. And I've spent a number of hours comparing the transmitted weather information with actual data. And I find there are many cases when it lets you down. And there are some cases when it correlates very nicely, and there are some cases when it correlates very nicely eventually, meaning it's been delayed for reasons I don't understand. So it really is not the same as having onboard detection systems. And the other issue is that, you know, I've been saying this for years, is that radar detects water and lightning detects the threat you're trying to avoid, which is the turbulence. And I can tell you that I have on many occasions had very vivid radar images at my 12 o'clock, strong magenta cells, and have looked at the strike finder and identified there's no lightning in them, and I'll fly right through them, and I have a smooth ride. And I remember one time around Toronto ATC was getting very upset. Oh, you got a, are you aware you have a cell at 12 o'clock? Yeah, I see it. Everybody's been going around it. No, it's okay. Do you want to deviate left or right? Of course. No, I don't need to deviate. Well, how's the ride up there? The ride is fine. And so you can actually depend on the lightning as a much more reliable indication of whether there's a threat. And you can also see occasions where there's lightning showing and the radar is showing next to nothing. And so if you were to fly that way, you would experience the opposite, which would be a very bad ride with no warning from the radar. And the other thing that distinguishes me from others is that for many years, I would call up flight service and I would say, well, where's the bad weather today? And they would say, well, where do you want to go? And I said, I want to go where the bad weather is. What?
They must have thought you were smoking something, John.
Well, they got used to me after a while. I began to hear some familiar voices eventually, and they said, oh, they kind of had the attitude, oh, you again. So I would go out on a daily basis looking for bad weather to test fly this instrument in the early days and to compare it against radar and storm scope, for that matter. And the so unlike pilots that go from A to B and encounter weather when it happens, I would go out and seek bad weather on every flight. So I have enormously more bad weather experience because that was the goal of many of my flights for thousands of hours. And so if you're doing your job right, even if you're an airline captain, well, you may see something on your radar once a week or maybe even less, right? You may do 100 flights and see no bad weather. Well, I wouldn't go anywhere if there wasn't bad weather. So,
completely different than the average GA pilot.
Yeah, it was a different thing. But the interesting thing is that, you know, it maybe it sounds a little crazy, but in reality, 98% of what I was doing was flying in clear air and no turbulence. And I was coming up to these things and looking at the indications, but I wasn't penetrating and I wasn't, you know, I never had bad or dangerous rides. So it was a fairly safe adventure, even though it sounds a little crazy, but it really was not the crazy thing you would think it would be. So based on that, I had a distinctly different idea and experience level on what radar will do and what lightning will do and what storm scope will do. And I can tell you that a lot of the information published about radar is simply foolish myth, but that would be the subject of another entire podcast.
Absolutely.
To get into that one.
So speaking about fact versus fiction and bad weather, how has this pesky pandemic impacted InSight and yourself?
Well, we don't see a huge difference, which is surprising. And I think that some of the customers out there have been laid off or furloughed, and they have more time to play with their airplane. so they're almost more active than they would be. Now, I don't know how you travel when there's no restaurants or hotels open. I'm not sure how that works, but obviously we're limited in our ability to cross the U.S. border, so I'm not going to be flying into the U.S. anytime soon. I don't know what I would have to do to get approval. I've heard some people get turned away when they land, so I don't want to experience that.
That would be annoying.
Yeah, that's right.
Hopefully they let them use the washroom before they're turned away.
And get some fuel.
You know, you've been in the aerospace industry for over 40 years. What's the biggest change that you've seen other than that new fad called the internet?
Well, the amount of technology we have working for us is a lot better than it used to be. And obviously the LCD screens and all these related things are a new deal. And I mean, when I developed the first graphic engine monitor, my only real choice was to go get a custom plasma display made. There was no such thing as an appropriate LCD screen at the time. And that's one thing. Some things that aren't any better, the level of expertise in the field has diminished. The level of, the ability to get one-time approvals has essentially gone away. And the approval process for getting something approved for use in an airplane has not gotten any better. Still is a huge job. And it takes lots of time and money to make it happen. I would like to see profound improvements in the approval process. And an interesting comparison to make is to go look at what you can buy for a boat and look at the cost and look at the pace of innovation in the boating industry. And it's enormously faster and better than it is in the aviation industry. Now, the market is probably substantially larger as well. But one thing they do is they install things in boats with essentially no approval process whatsoever. So the burdens that we have for innovation and the amount of time we have to spend before we can put a device in the airplane, that burden is all gone in the boating industry. And it's interesting to see the effect that it has.
It would be great to see some regulatory reform from a GA, business aviation perspective. So, John, what's next on the horizon for Insight?
Well, we're always innovating. We're always exploring things. We explore a fair number of things and throw some of those away because they're not going to work or they're not going to be valuable. And we pick the best ones and we run with it. And so we're always in the process of innovating and selecting new ideas to go into the airplane.
Well, John, thank you so much for being part of Plane Talk. Any final words for the listeners?
No, it was good fun, and there's always more stories to tell.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Plane Talk. If you have any ideas for a future Plane Talk episode, please go to the Contact Us page at planetalk.ca and send in your idea. Don't forget to like us at planetalk.ca, our Facebook and LinkedIn pages, and this podcast. And never stop living the dream.